Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome you this evening at the London School of Economics for this second lecture, which is a series of lectures on Europe, which the European Institute organizes jointly with People's Europe. The first lecture, as some of you might remember, was a lecture which was given by Hugo Young and which was about Euroscepticism. This evening we have the pleasure on an entirely different topic, nevertheless related to Europe, to welcome John Monks, the General Secretary of the TUC, who will be talking to us about the European model of social partnership. This is a public lecture which will have slightly different structure than our usual public lectures, since John will be talking for about 30 minutes. We have two of our discussants, one of my colleague, David Marston, who is Professor of Industrial Relations at the LSE, and Matthew Taylor, who is the director of the Institute for Public Policy Research. And of course, not the least, it's also a very great pleasure, of course, to welcome here tonight the very well-known Will Hatton, the director of the Industrial Society, who has accepted to chair this panel. On these few words of introduction, I would again like to thank you all for being present here, but of course thank all our participants, and we'll leave the floor to Will, who will introduce our speaker tonight. Thank you very much.
I've known John Monks for longer than both of us care to remember. And his views and mine are also extraordinarily close. But I've just come back from Frankfurt, where I've been interviewing Wim Duesenberg, because although I'm director of the Industrial Society, I'm also carrying on as a columnist and occasional interviewer for The Observer. And Duesenberg, in the course of this hour and a half interview, which will be published in The Observer on Sunday, declared that as an economic liberal, believer in free markets, believer in cultural diversity, believer in a multiplicity of economic and social models in Europe, a skeptic about social partnership, sounding completely like David Owen. It was for this reason that he was passionately committed to the single currency and the euro. And I thought the whole terms of the debate about this are a million miles away from London. I mean, there is an hour and a half flight away, you know, completely kind of foreign country altogether. But social partnership in Europe is under stress. Some of you will have noticed that the French employers this week have withdrawn from administration of the Social Security Fund in France, and that was set up after the First World War, and is an exemplar, really, of continental models of social partnership. They're insisting on the flexibility and looking to the British model as one in which, that's not explicitly what they're saying. They're saying they want flexibility and remain skeptical about the British model, but wonder whether there should be some movement towards it. In Germany, Duesenberg reports that industry-wide collective bargaining agreements of the type that Metall-Gesellschaft are going for, looking for 5.5%, are one of the reasons why he may have to put interest rates up in the months ahead. On the other hand, these Europeans have absolutely no desire to shed all their traditions of social solidarity, but want to refashion them. What does it mean? Is there a moving towards them and a moving towards us? Is there some point in the middle of the channel where our two models should meet? Maybe the British economic and social model is a European model after all, and not an American model. What does John Monks make of it all? I think with no more ado, we should invite John to get going. And he's going to talk for around half an hour. Our discussants are going to discuss for 7 or 8 minutes, and we're all going to leave here between 7:45 and 8:00. That's our plan. With no more ado, John Monks.
Will, thank you very much. It's always a risk when you're the chairman of any lecture or talk that one is about to give, because you've usually heard something more up-to-date than the lecturer. And I was sitting there just listening to, obviously, a very interesting week you've been having. Because my theme is very similar to the remarks that Will made in his opening. I mean, is social partnership on a course of mortality? Is it on its way to the graveyard, along with tripartitism of the British type, to be laid to rest side by side? Advocate for a consensual approach to relationships at work, to building mutual respect and relationships of good quality between workers and employers, get away from adversarialism and all that. And we have been pleased to see that growing as a concept in many British companies. Our ambition is to re-establish some kind of relationship like that at the national level. And I have to say to date that we have not succeeded. That's including the period since May 1997. And making more of a continuum between what happens at the European level, what happens at the workplace level, with some national level coherent basis for handling some of the changes and taking place in the labour market and the interventions which of necessity the government are making. The one labour market issue on which something approaching social partnership has been tried, ironically on an issue of which the origin is totally domestic, the national minimum wage, that has to date been the most successful intervention since 1997 in the labour market. The Low Pay Commission was established. George Bain was the chairman, three from the TUC, three from the CBI, some independents, rather traditional 1970s model, who did a very good job on what was a complicated issue. Sold a rate, £3.60 for adults, which was lower than a lot of trade unionists ever thought, that we thought we'd get more than that, or quite a lot thought they'd get more than that. And nonetheless, the Congress backed the Low Pay Commission because it was a process we recognised, and we could see that it was an intelligent approach to a difficult subject. On other issues, including European-generated measures, working time is the was the first in line after 1997. This approach has not been used, and the government and the CBI refused to use something that could be recognised as a social partnership approach, and instead the system was parallel lobbying. With business lobbyists busy around from Downing Street, around Parliament and other places. The TUC busy in the same places, but often using the internal mechanisms and pressures of the Labour Party backbenchers to seek to make advances. The results, I can't say have been too happy so far. Working time is on its third revision, generally speaking, is reflecting rather badly on the whole European social thrust as applied by British policy making. Those of you from the union employer world who've dealt with working time will just know how complicated that has arisen, of all sorts of compromises have been made, some of which are pretty impracticable. So, I might just say on parental leave, that's not been happy either. The TUC, advised by one Sherry Booth, as you may have heard yesterday, is in the process of seeking judicial review of the government's introduction of parental leave in on December the 15th. And on part-time workers, which is next in the queue, the consultative document went out on Monday, and the regulations are due for implementation on April the 7th, the ridiculously compressed time for wider consideration of this issue. And I sympathise with employers who may have to, will have to implement the measures by April the 7th, or face the possibility of some litigation from somebody. It's not working well, the implementation of social legislation as far as Britain is concerned. So, leaving that for a moment, the origins, of course, of these measures go back to the early days of the 70s, to the reaction to the restructuring which took place after the oil shock of 73. It produced what was called the three-pack of worker protection and consultation measures because of the big rise in unemployment that took place in the European, what's now the European Union, at that stage. Collective redundancies, transfers of undertakings, and insolvency were the three issues covered. Equal treatment followed shortly, and then some material on health and safety. And together with the concepts that were developed, particularly under the Delors presidency, the idea of a social pillar alongside the economic pillar got stronger. The social package gradually extended from health and safety into working time, which has been the subject of such a lot of difficulty in the British context. Interestingly, not in other countries, not in the Republic of Ireland, for example, where the issue was settled after a two-day meeting between employers, the government and unions, with a programme which has been regarded as generally satisfactory and useful all round, as far as, because there's gains to be made from work organisation if overtime is cut, and overtime was as much a feature of Irish culture as it was of British culture. The caravan of social legislation then moved on from working hours, rather logically, towards family-friendly policies in an effort to balance the ever-stronger pressures for on workers to work harder, perhaps work longer, which are particularly marked in this country. British men work the longest hours of any occupational group in the European Union. And so we've now got the system since Maastricht of dialogues between employers and unions at the European level, in some cases producing agreement on parental leave, part-time workers and fixed-term work, the three subjects already covered. So in a sense, the processes of social partnership still move and move on. And agreements of a collective kind have been made on an EU-wide basis. And there are now more than 20 sectoral social dialogue committees working at the European level. Wages are excluded from the social chapter. And this sore strikes, by the way, but with EMU and all the transparency that comes with it, there's clear effects for wages in what is now developing. The single market quickened the process, but EMU steps up several gears. Already Belgium has aligned its statutory annual wage increase with the wage increases in the neighbouring countries. Cross-border areas, and there's a particular emphasis at the moment on the sort of Ruhr to northern France through Benelux, are very clear that wage comparability will be essential to the economic health of that particular region of the European Union. The wage transparency also operates at multinational companies level. Surveys show that an overwhelming majority of multinational companies expect the euro to lead to common remuneration programs. Some are already seeing that pan-European pay negotiations are a likely rather than an unlikely feature. Now, differences of productivity levels, differences in the rate of productivity increase, inevitably must feature in European wage developments. And there'll be all sorts of problems you can see in public services and the social economy, and probably in some service sectors. It won't be as easy as multinational manufacturing or financial services areas. But nonetheless, We do know that the annual bargaining rounds in a number of countries, particularly in this core of the European Union, are now being actively discussed. Again, a million miles from the British experience. The unions already actually feel, the European continental unions, or as I prefer increasingly to train myself to say, the mainland European unions, feel that their transnational cooperation on bargaining policy is already showing positive effects. And they regard that they've got a formula of inflation plus productivity, which is spreading out from this this core region. And the European TUC, which is an important body in the social partnership institutions of the European Union, is already swapping information around people who are more on the periphery about what's going on in the core. The next impact on wages policy comes through efforts to coordinate macroeconomic policy. I mentioned the European Employment Pact. I don't want to labour it because it's more in the wish than the fulfilment at the moment. But the idea, rather quaint to many British economists, that macroeconomic policy is related to wage movements, and that some national degree of control can be exerted on wage movements, is still one with a lot of support in many of the chancelleries and councils of the European Union. And a series of meetings have been taking place at the technical level, at the political level, about how to handle moves to boost employment and at the same time control wage inflation. Mr. Duesenberg very much involved in those processes. It's undoubtedly true that a significant number of employers in a significant number of countries do see the European Union as a way of undermining the high levels of either wages or welfare states which have been established in their particular countries, and are looking for it to achieve at the European level what domestic politics won't allow at home. An interesting battle taking place, and one in which we're reasonably confident that we've got a pretty good chance through both domestic politics and politics at the European Union level of hanging on to quite a lot of the gains which have been made on the social side by the peoples of the European Union. EMU is having another important impact on European industrial relations. The degrees of the cross-border mergers, the restructurings and so on, which are clearly taking place, we believe will be accelerated considerably by the firming up of the euro as it becomes more and more the norm not just in the European Union, by the way, but probably outside as well in many spheres and fields. The Commission has been mindful of this, bringing forward the European Works Council directive to try and give workers some safety net of protection against the mega deals and the new strategies that are cooked up in the boardrooms, often to maximise shareholder. Please shareholders, rather in too many cases, actually provide a basis for organic growth of the business. A new three pack of measures includes a revision of the European Works Council directive, the adoption of draft directives on workers' involvement in a European company, and the information and consultation rights for employees in the European Community. These are all being opposed. These are all about power in particular companies, all being opposed by employers, including the CBI, at the European level. With the British government's active support, by the way, our government has committed itself to a strategy of blocking the draft directive on information and consultation in the Council of Ministers. There is actually a thriller to be written, starring Adair Turner, Roger Liddell and Peter Mandelson as the trio of operators who managed to set this blocking mechanism up. We, on the other hand, are dedicated to seeing if we can undermine that through the various alliances which can be made in the European Union. And I just say the interesting time next will come when the French take over the presidency of the European Union. The ETUC and the TUC have argued that some rules injected into these restructurings are a necessary condition to maintain any sort of popular support for the European Union and for the notion that workers should be at least receive some minimally decent levels of treatment at a time when it's likely to be huge restructurings of European business. If we are with the euro in the era that the United States was in after the Civil War, which saw the growth of the huge continental-wide companies, then how that process is done? Well, I think the European Commission is certainly alive to the fact that it could be very difficult if there are no rules at all that bite on corporate governance. There's been support for this idea from the high-level group on industrial change, which Gyllenhammar, who was the chairman of Commercial Union, was the chairman of Volvo, was the leading figure in there. All these issues come up at Lisbon in March. The British government pressing very much for a social dimension, which concentrates on employability, on training, on learning new skills, all of which we accept and support extremely important, but not at the expense of minimum labour standards and some basic rules on the way that companies should behave. We hear that the euro will not work efficiently if we don't get greater flexibility. Indeed, it's certainly one of the five convergence criteria that the government has laid down in terms of a condition for British entry into the euro. But I say this, if we're waiting for mainland Europe to change, we could wait a long time. It's a gross caricature to describe the eurozone economies as sclerotic. There's some pretty massive changes underway on the other side of the channel, but they are doing it their way. And while some of them would like to do it our way, I believe the outcomes are not necessarily what the employer lobby and perhaps the banking lobby particularly seek. And that will become apparent when there's wider attention given to the papers that are being done at the moment for the Lisbon summit. And why I said at the start that I think this is the field on which the great game about how our societies are governed in future is being fought is that if the emphasis is on a rather American Wild West approach to all these restructurings and this process of change, well, what price the kind of values and rules which trade unions and many others have traditionally espoused? Yet the prize, if the European partnership approach can be adapted to cope with these changes, to provide safety nets, to provide confidence in people affected by change, that their interests at least are being taken into account, then I think that is a great prize to be pursued. Well, the US economy, of course, has been the great exemplar of the 1990s, very close to full employment in many, many parts of the United States. It shows, by the way, the value of macroeconomic policies which have given growth a chance. The US economy is entering its ninth year of economic recovery. In contrast, of course, it's not been a good decade for much of Europe. The economic non-recovery. The US has shown, too, the potential long-term opportunities from developing the new technologies, and in a sense is in the position in relation to electronic technology that Britain was in relation to the railways. But what, in fact, doesn't come out of this is that the European social model is costing jobs, strangling productivity, or creating social exclusion. The OECD, which in many ways would agree with much of Mr. Duesenberg's analysis reported on by Will, has found recently that there's no link between levels of employment protection and rates of long-term job creation. And nor do they damage productivity. In today's world, workplace productivity leaders, to a large measure, not in all sectors, but in many, are the social partnership economies of Northern and Western Europe. In contrast, the OECD finds high levels of social protection and collective bargaining mean wages and incomes are rather more equal than in other kinds of societies. And it's certainly true that the benefits of growth in the US are not being fairly shared. Most American families have over the past decade seen very little growth in real incomes, and those at the top have seen some considerable increases, 15 times more than those at the bottom. So I don't believe that we can accept the policy proposition that people seek to give us between two alternatives of low unemployment or greater social inequality. I believe that EMU and the model, the modern European social model in the next decade does offer a chance for US-style sustained economic recovery combined with a European-style commitment to social justice and fairness. If that is the third way, I'm very happy to support it. Will, over to the rest of you.
John, thank you. Now, actually, I was listening to you, I was thinking that the first round effect of EMU actually is being, something close to Thatcherization in Europe. I mean, there's an amazing, accelerating program of liberalization going on. At the same time, unions and social partners are trying to preserve, you know, the best of the European model. It's a very intriguing story at the moment, because and I'm very interested to see what our discussants bring this out, whether we bring this out in the question and answer session. I think it's, in some respects, getting a fix on that is the key to getting a fix on. Where the model will survive. Who wants to go first, David or?
Do you want to, Matthew?
Matthew, why don't you go first? And why don't you put your mouth near the microphone?
Thanks, Will. John, your talk could lead to, I think, a whole number of very interesting discussions and a whole lot of points I'd like to make in response, but I'll restrict myself to two. The first is just to say something about the nature of sort of discourse around the European social model versus, as it were, the US-UK Anglo-Saxon model in terms of industrial policy and economic policy. To say something about the nature of that discourse and how I think we need to put it in some context. And then secondly, to say something about how possibly we need to think about unbundling the concept of social partnership and the outcome of particular forms of regulation of employment. So in terms of the first point, just an uncomfortable, perhaps it's not an uncomfortable fact, but an important fact, I think, to say about what's happening in the United States, and that is that despite the policy framework there, it appears to be the case that in those areas where there is full employment, a rising tide is lifting all boats, that people at the bottom of the income distribution are actually seeing real increases over the last few years. In fact, what's happening is the rich are getting much richer, the poor are getting a little bit richer, and the people in the middle are not doing very well. And I think that tells us actually something about who those people in the middle are and about the need for the sorts of skills which they traditionally had. But I think that the fact that in the specific circumstances of full employment, those sorts of policies that one associates with that model do appear to lift the poorest out, in some senses, in some ways at least, out of some of the worst effects of poverty. The second element around this point is that Blair, New Labour always says what matters is what works. So I think in the sort of history of economic writing, the the phrase would be, what works represents the one and only best way of managing the economy and industry, by which I mean, I don't know if there is a law, but I'd like to suggest a law, which is the point at which any model of industrial or economic policy is globally hailed by economists and pundits is the moment immediately prior to its collapse. The Swedish model, the German model, the Asian Tigers, and now, of course, the American model. It only takes a major readjustment in the American stock market, which is long overdue, for that model similarly to come crashing around people's ears, just as it's been described as the only way forward. And the real point there is that industrial policy needs to be understood in its specific national and historical context. I mean, there is one view, talking to people involved in trying to get the Alliance for Jobs going in Germany, that in order for Germany to modernise and to increase employment, a sort of Thatcherite destruction of existing structures, culture of social partnership has to happen. Now, this may be the case. It may be that corporatism, that centralised bargaining structures act as a barrier when rapid, painful changes are required, especially if that change is particularly going to affect those currently in work. But it's worth making two contrasting points. The first is that in the Netherlands, reform of welfare and employment policy took place led by governments of the left and the right, and both those governments did it with the negotiation with trade unions. It was done on a sort of corporatist basis. So it is possible there are examples of those sorts of painful transitions being undertaken in a more consensual way. And the other thing I think that's important is that we now, of course, move into a situation where we have full employment in parts of London and the South East. And while we're New Labour zealots are happily skipping around saying that there can be no return to the old days of corporatism, it's interesting to imagine what will happen when the first strike takes place in a McDonald's. The picket line forms outside McDonald's, and McDonald's phone up other branches across London, the South East, and say, you must send your staff over, it's quite appalling. The staff in all those other McDonald's say, well, we're not going to strike break, we don't need to, we can always get a job at Burger King. And one suspects that in those circumstances, the leaders of the workers will be called in for meetings of ministers, and their demands will be assessed, and hey presto, will be some return in some way, however grudgingly, to the sorts of engagement between government and employers and employees that which we've been told is a matter of the past. And I think it would be surprising if full employment did not lead to a more assertive, more self-confident workers and trade unions. The only other point I want to make about this question of public discourse is just that I think it's worth linking the degree to which the hubris around how wonderfully Britain and America are doing to why it's so difficult for us to get public support for the euro. I mean, if we go around saying that European economies are poorly managed and they need to learn from us, it's not surprising that people say, well, why would we want to be part of a European economy which is terribly out of date and needs to catch up with us? So I think that there's a slight contradiction there in the Labour message, and not the only one. The second point I want to make sure I make more briefly is this point about the need possibly to unbundle in terms of the way we talk about it. The processes of social partnership and the particular outcome which we associate with those processes, which is that of regulation. I think that one of the reasons why the Working Time Directive got such a bad press was that it was able to be portrayed by its opponents as something which was going to constrain workers as well as constrain managers. It was something that was going to stop people who wanted to work long hours working long hours. And of course, that's not that's largely untrue. But nevertheless, that perception was very damaging to it. And we have to recognise that whilst there are millions of people who work longer hours than they want to by necessity, there are also millions of people who work longer hours than they need to because they enjoy their jobs. They're part of teams at work which encourage them, or they just don't like going home to their family. I'm always reminded of Nicholas Ridley when he was asked to resign in the House, and he said, I'm not going to resign. The last thing I want to do is spend more time with my family. More seriously, there is evidence. The evidence that you see is always incredibly overblown, but nevertheless, I think it is significant that the evidence is emerging from some of the studies about the sort of Generation Xs in the US, which seems to show that that many of them say that they want very flexible working patterns. They want to work 80 hours week one, and then they want to work 2 days week two because they want to go snowboarding or whatever. You know, that actually the whole sort of the whole culture of 9 to 5 just doesn't fit. And of course, in a context of full employment, if one's talking about these people being, for example, in a demand area like new technology, they will be able to determine quite often the working patterns which they have. And I think it's important in that context that we always assert that the main objective of improvements in employment, the context of employment, is about giving workers more choice and more control, not about finding ever more complex ways of regulating for the sake of regulation. Now, I'm sure that it isn't regulation for regulation's sake that John is encouraging, but I think that is still, in terms of public perception, a too common a perception. And I think, finally to close, there are implications there for the future of trade unionism, how people perceive membership of trade unions. And I think John is actually doing a lot of extremely interesting work on that.
Thank you. I was thinking, while you were talking, I was thinking about Holland, because Holland has got full employment, and they have picked up this point that John was making, that you should differentiate between the consequences of strong protection on employment, which the Dutch are committed to, and actually organising your wage bargaining system so that you don't have, you know, collective agreements across the entire country. And they've gone for decentralised wage bargaining, both by Dutch region and by Dutch industry, at the same time as actually raising the level of social protection on part-time work. It's kind of a very interesting kind of, you know, trade-off there. And you know, they have got something close to full employment. Indeed, the economy is arguably overheating. It's intriguing. I mean, you know, there is a way in which the Dutch are actually both actually moving in what, you know, a Eurosceptic might say an Anglo-American model, but also, you know, protecting the best of the European social model. And that's why this debate is complicated, and, you know, trying to pull out those complications, I think, is at the heart of it. David.
Thank you. I think John's defense of the European social model comes at a very appropriate time. You mentioned Lisbon, and I guess one of the items which will be discussed is the enlargement of the European Union, and whether we go from this relatively small number of countries now to practically doubling the size of the European Union. And of course, that does raise a very important issue of the relationship between economics in terms of extending the European single currency and the European market, and on the other side, the question of extending the social infrastructure and the political frameworks of Europe. And the European social model, I feel, is very much part of the institutional fabric of the European Union. And one has to look at its capacity for extension very closely when one's considering the wider aspect of extending the European market. I think the two can expand at very different rates, and I'd like to support John's arguments but also add to them, I think. The old European social model, it's perhaps worth distinguishing two European social models, an old one and a new one. The old one is one, I think, very much identified with laws and regulations, and this is very much, I suppose, the caricature of the European social model. And a strong emphasis on legal regulation. And one can see the weaknesses of some of that kind of approach in the events like the French truck driver's strike, where France, of course, has an approach that rests rather heavily on legal regulation and formal regulation through industry-level agreements, but a weak representation of workers in the workplace and in the office. And what happens is one then has people who can't express their grievances very effectively, except in major social explosions. And as we've seen from the truck drivers' disputes in France and the public service disputes and so on, these can be very disruptive. And I think one has to think about the kind of mechanisms by which one can resolve these disputes. Extending the European market and relying on the economic pressures of integration, which John mentioned, the forces of pay comparability, the mechanisms which go with the integration of companies and so on, I think perhaps leaves us very exposed to the kind of disputes, very disruptive disputes, which we've seen recently in France. There are two dimensions, I think, to the European social model. The old model perhaps puts rather a lot of emphasis on the substantive regulation side of it. The other dimension I think we have to devote much more attention to is the aspect of procedures and perhaps more social partnership than laws and directives and regulations. And whereas the old model, I think, does appear very rigid and attracts a lot of criticism for its rigidity, the partnership aspect offers the scope for being extremely flexible. And I think, again, if we look at France, Martine Aubry's big success with working time reduction hasn't been the formal change of regulations about working time. And I don't think Martine Aubry and Léonin Jospin will achieve an increase in employment by the mere fact of reducing working time in France. If they do achieve an increase in employment, it'll be because working time reduction has been used as a means of stimulating negotiation at the industry, in particular at the company level, and to has been a means of enriching social dialogue within the enterprise. I think that kind of partnership and that aspect of the European social model can be very flexible, whereas the older style legalistic approach can be extremely rigid. Now, why does this become an issue at the time of enlargement? I think it's easy to extend rules and directives across 15, 30, 33 countries. Politicians are very good at that. What's much more difficult is building the process of partnership. A long time ago, Ludwig Erhard, when he was setting out the strengths of the social market economy for Germany, stressed, and I think he stressed very wisely, that the social market economy was a method of organizing a society, of regulating disputes within a society. It wasn't a set of rules and it wasn't a set of outcomes. And I think it's well worth and developing that aspect of the European social model. I think if Germany has been a very flexible and very adaptive economy over the last few decades, it's because the workplace co-determination, the methods of the practice of social partnership in Germany has kept a strong emphasis on the method side rather than the substantive rule side. Germany nearly went wrong with the working time reductions, approaching it in a very formal way, developing very general rules. I think the way the working time debate has evolved in Germany has put much greater emphasis on local negotiations and local measures to make working time more flexible and reduce working hours within a more flexible framework. But this can only be done by perhaps at sectoral level between sectoral employers and sectoral unions, and at the company level by worker representatives and management at those levels. Now, this is flexible, but the problem from the point of view of the European social model is that, unlike laws and industry-wide and national collective agreements, the flexible method has very uneven coverage. And I think the big challenge for the European social model in coming years is to develop the coverage aspect. If one can't develop the coverage of the practice of social partnership, then it's very difficult to hold it up as a realistic alternative to the more legalistic and more rigid approach. Now, this, I think, has very severe implications for the balance between deepening Europe's institutions, I mean here particularly Europe's social institutions and social partnership, and enlargement and the various geopolitical considerations about whether Ukraine should be a member and so on. I'd like to finish with just one illustration from Germany, which is held up as, at least in Britain, held up as the model of social partnership. There was a very interesting study done by a German sociologist, Kotthoff, looking at works councils in Germany in the middle 1970s and then revisiting the same works councils in the early 1990s. Now, it's interesting because we have a vision of works councils as partnership in practice. The Germans have a more involved view of this. His study in the middle 1970s found that roughly 40% of the works councils in his sample could be characterized as being dominated by management. The other 60% were effective representatives of the workers. It's not quite the rosy, strong representative institution that one sometimes imagines from the island off the mainland. But what he also found when he revisited the same works councils 15 years later was that at least half of the dominated weak works councils had turned into fully representative, effective works councils. And what achieved it? Well, he argued from his research that it was the action of local trade union activists together with the support from their industry trade union. It was the activity of the workers and the trade unionists themselves which had achieved this transformation of management-dominated works councils into works councils that were effectively representing their members. But it took a long time. It took 15 years. And I think there are two lessons I draw from this. Partnership takes time to grow and mature. It's not something which can be decreed from Brussels. It's not something which can be just switched on. And secondly, it depends very much also on the efforts of rank and file members. One can't have partnership from on top. And this, I think, does mean that we have to consider very carefully the position of the European social model within the debate about enlargement of the European Union. It's already, I mean, John's talk illustrates the difficulties of extending many aspects of the partnership side of the European social model to Britain. I think it's even more difficult to extend it beyond the bounds that we've come to think of as part of Europe. So we can rely on economics to help drive the European social model and its extension, but only so far, because I think we have to watch the ability of social partnership to grow and function, and that is a very slow process. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I'm listening to David, I'm wondering whether he actually thinks that, you know, we should give up if it's all so difficult. And that made me then think it's about time that even this debate amongst people who are interested in Europe, I mean, should be done in the context of more self-confidence about the European case and actually some true recognition of the strengths and weaknesses of the European economy. For example, information technology represents 23% of the market capitalization of the US stock exchange. We know that. It represents, IT stocks represents 11% of the market capitalization of the Japanese stock market, 9% of the German stock market, 7% of the French stock market, and super flexible Britain on the verge of an economic boom and an exemplar to the whole of Europe, 1.6%. You know, I mean, this notion that actually Europe is a busted flush and we're actually the future, you know, does actually require, I think, some challenge. Job generation in France in 1999, proportionately, was the biggest in the OECD. And that was consistent with inflation of below 2%. Economic growth in the EU in 2000 will be 3%. It will rise to 4% in 2001. You know, Duisenberg is worrying about overheating in Spain, Denmark, Holland, Ireland, and Portugal. And watching the French economy really simmering. What's holding it back is what's going on in Germany and Italy. You know, I mean, there's a kind of context in which this debate takes place, in which, you know, the whole of Europe is seen as, you know, on its last legs. Extension of the social model is in tatters. America is actually a new economic paradigm. We which itself, as Matthew said, has probably too many people incarcerated in the US, you know, for example. I mean, we do need, I think, you know, just a bit of course correction before we open up this debate. Just for quite having, you know, these three excellent presentations, and you think, well, you know, it's all a bit defensive, you know, we can really go on the attack a bit or something. Anyway, love to hear your contributions. Let's get a questioning. There's one there, there's one over there. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Can you stand up, actually, and... question. Anyone else? Let's take two or three at a time. Lastly, before we listen to this round of questions, yeah.
I'm just wondering from what part of the political spectrum any kind of support for a very sensible and far-reaching notion that we've been hearing tonight is likely to come. Is it going to come from Mr. Hague's Conservatives? Is it going to come from the New Labour? It's just a little difficult to see where we can start rallying support for these kinds of notions.
So where are we going to get the political support? What about notion of citizenship? And actually, how do you layer partnership at the micro level in such a way that it actually works? I guess that's paraphrasing your question, Francis. Anyway, sorry, so let's go. John.
The first question about layered and diverse representation, I think the... I mean, if you look at the different statutes that have been introduced into Britain resulting from European legislation, there's a pattern that a body should be created for whom, to whom an employer should talk about redundancies or transfers of undertakings or restructurings and so on. That's not necessarily a trade union, and it may not be a standing body. It may be a body called into being at a particular time for a particular issue. I see the tidying up process in the information and consultation proposals, which would create some sort of works council arrangement in the companies to which it applied. At the moment, the draft directive says those that employ more than 50. that, I mean, many in the union world don't like that. After all, the union sector, collectively bargained for sector, covers 48% of British workers, less a proportion in the private sector, but the it's still a significant presence, and they would see that as a rival. I tend to see it, and David's figures bore out the German experience. I would be less pessimistic than you about the how I think that unions could coexist quite happily with the with that arrangement. They would work more and more through it, and they would have to take their chances in elections and so on, but it would be a means of organizing which would be new and I think would be democratic and would be acceptable in a way that trade union organizing of a more traditional kind, and maybe even with recognition legislation added on, perhaps wouldn't be. Citizenship and partnership, well,
and the TUC.
And the TUC. I think Anthony Mayer will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was Monet who said that the British can grasp a fact but never an idea. And I was a member of the Commission on Citizenship a few years ago, and most of us were still struggling to grasp the idea, clearly, at the end of that that commission. And I personally, I don't see the necessity for a constitutional upheaval to precede these things we were talking about. A more pragmatic approach of building on particular things that we've got appeals to my, in this case, very Anglo-Saxon mind. Where on the political spectrum? I certainly not given up on the Labour Party at all. And strategically, although you may have caught not just some defensiveness but bits of depression occasionally seeping into my lecture, the 26 new rights that workers have got or are getting since 1997, the employer reaction, which is we're being swamped with all these things, which is a gross exaggeration, but nonetheless, they're having to get used to the tide going in a different direction than was the case between 1980 and 1997. So strategically, things are moving. We would like to move a bit faster, and we would like perhaps to be advocated with a bit more enthusiasm. Interesting, in Labour's Euro election manifesto, there was no mention at all of any of the social measures that were being introduced. It was considered that this was not in front of the voter, that this could be mentioned. I think that was a profound mistake, because voting for Europe, even under the context of the broad campaign of Britain in Europe, which isn't specifically about the Euro, you need things to engage the popular mind. And whether it's parental leave or some attempt at 4 weeks paid holiday, by the way, in the working time regulations, which is nice and simple and people grasp, these are the things that a Labour government needs to start trumpeting, and they are things that people will rally to. If the silence on that, silence on the Euro, silence on a broader vision of a federal Europe or whatever it might be, then there's not a lot left to rally anybody to, and the sceptics have got the best songs.
Well, there we go. I wonder whether Matthew, Daly, do you want a kind of footnote, point, question, issue to raise?
I'll be very quick. One of the great things about being a think tank director is not expect you to be an expert about anything, so therefore I won't even attempt to answer the first question. In terms of where change is going to come from, I mean, I suggested, and I do think it is worth saying again, that change, that full employment will make change happen. I think it will, you know, it does change the balance of power in the workplace, it does change the balance of power in the economy, and it will have consequences, and those consequences have to be managed. No one say it'll be it'll simply be a replaying of the 60s, but nevertheless, I think it will have an impact. In terms of politically, where change comes from, I mean, John's obviously right talking about the things that have happened with Labour, but there doesn't seem to me, as you indicate, John, much idea of where the next steps are going to be. And at the moment, I think the chapter heading better, you know, better employment in the next manifesto looks pretty, looks like it, you know, may just be a chapter heading moving straight on to the next chapter heading with nothing in it. And I think part of that is, you know, we have to, you know, we recognise the nature of modern politics is that politicians will bend to public opinion, and it is still the case, it remains the case, however unfair and unreasonable it is the case, that people see business as being of the future and positive, and people still see trade unions as being of the past, and it's changing, it's not as bad as it was, but it is still the case. And I think that the rebranding, and John has led this, I think, but the rebranding of trade unions, and particularly trying to get young people to feel trade unions are relevant to them, is an incredibly important part of that task. I think, to say one line, John, I think the trade union's relationship to the Labour Party is one of the worst parts of its branding. It nearly always damages the trade union because it speaks to backroom deals and all sorts of...
Mayor of London.
Well, yeah, Mayor of London, Ken Jackson, and all that stuff. You know, I think it's damaging. And I also made the point, I think it's important that trade unions should be seen about promoting choice rather than about promoting regulation per se. The final thing is that this point about citizenship. I mean, you know, citizenship is a complex concept because it speaks of citizen of what as a collective concept in one sense. On the other hand, it's also about individuals and individual rights. And I think, as I hinted this earlier, but maybe we could develop it later, that one of the things that has to happen with trade unions and trade union membership is people need to see it as being a more of an individualistic thing, that you join a trade union as an individual decision for life and it follows you around, rather than the current model of trade union membership, which is that it's something which goes with a particular workplace or with a particular trade or with a particular point in your life. And I think one needs to have a promotion, which rather goes with, I think, what was being said earlier about empowering workers. A notion that joining a trade union is something you do at university or wherever, and you do it forever, and it's something which you carry around with you as an access to information, as a form of empowerment wherever you work.
Were you happy with John's answer on citizenship? Just stand up and we'll see.
Sorry.
Can anyone hear at the back?
Yeah, okay. What I was trying to get at was that even though other European countries have had moments of crisis, those moments of crisis have forced them to re-examine the relationship between the people at the managerial level of society, the governmental, or the industrial, and at the working level of society. That debate has never happened here. I think compared to the European model, we're close to in terms of how we view ourselves as individual citizens. And it seems to me that the TUC has a potential to appeal to people because it can support the notion of citizenship. Otherwise, what are rights? How can you understand rights if you can't understand citizenship? I don't see it.
There's two contributions here. People raise their hands. Actually, there's a very interesting book that I just finished, which they ask rhetorically, ask a Frenchman, 20th century Frenchman, a Kalahari Bushman, and a 19th century Russian peasant woman who they are, what would the answer that come back? And the Kalahari Bushman would obviously say, really push, would say, you know, tribe, it's belong to tribe. And the Russian, you know, peasant woman might say something about, you know, mother or family. And really only French person might say citizenship. And with it goes all kinds of conceptions, as you say, of modernity, rights, equality of rights. And, you know, it is almost an alien concept in Britain, I think. I think you're right. Anyway, yeah.
Can I just ask one question relating to corporate governance, which was mentioned in one by John, which was very interesting. In the context of, I thought it was a very interesting picture of social partnership, not so much as legal regulation, but almost as a culture. If we are to have and try to pursue that, I think it's quite attractive and interesting. If we are to try to pursue that, make it real, as opposed to abstract notions that don't come around, who are we to partner with? It seems to me that, one should mention the bourgeois in this sort of context, but there is a group of super rich who are known as super arrogant, who seem to escape control, regulation, taxation, etc. They are, in fact,
in one sense with big corporations, in one sense. What are we partners with? What's the reality? I find it then difficult to bring to ground, other than start talking about a sense of our responsibility and what that we should be. And we know that.
Thank you. That's, yeah, you've got it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to make.
You stand up again, Susie.
I'd like to make a point about theory, the relationship between theory and labor. I don't think that the relationship between the labor movement and European integration is anything but a deeply problematic relationship. And I don't think the solution to it is going to be easy either. I think it goes back a long way in the history of labor.
I don't really understand what your hard question is from that, or from those observations.
Well, for example, economic determinism in the late has gone out. Marxist pedigree, I suppose you could trace it back to Robin, but it's predominantly got a Marxist pedigree. I accept the third way, always by Anthony Giddens.
Yes, then, yeah.
If I may, come back on this point about citizenship and rights, because I'm staggered that a leading member of the trade union movement seems to have forgotten what the trade union movement was all about, which was establishing workers' rights. An awful lot of the things which we're trying to get to citizenship and human rights. I mean, if I'd ask the question, why did every time a Bill of Rights comes up before the UK Parliament, it's always modified to the point where it actually denies the point of its existence. And really think it's a question of enforcing them for the rights is really what's missing. And I think that's the cardinal point that needs to be made.
John, I think you should have a chance to fire back at that, and then we'll take a couple more and we'll wind up, and I think David wants to. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I understand the argument about rights and so on. At the risk of sounding like a particularly crusty member of the House of Lords or something, I know we're all subjects of the Crown in Britain. That's our legal status. But hardly anybody knows about it. Hardly anybody cares about it. People don't feel they're in pre-revolutionary France and haven't done for a long time, despite oppression in different ways at different times, not least in the work environment. And degree of interest in the issue around the place, and I've at different times of my life been very interested in it. I've not found too many soulmates. I'm finding more here actually than I've found for a long time. So there's a huge constitutional agenda out there at the moment, of which I think the central one is Europe and how we relate to Europe. It's our destiny to get that right. And in a way, it may be intellectual laziness, or as New Labour might call it, focus, but it's not really on my perspective at the moment of things to give a lot of thought to. So with that, again, another very Anglo-Saxon answer, I pass back to the chairman, who's that's much more continental on these matters.
Yes, and was that commonsensical enough for you? Dave.
Thank you. Well, I think on the citizenship question, this is something which is being posed in all the European countries at the moment. France is obviously concerned about the legal definition of citizenship and what changes in the European Union might be doing to that. Germany has its own problems of only recently abandoned blood definitions of citizenship in Germany. So we're not the only countries facing this choice. And I think in a way the whole issue is raised with a Europe building Europe in a way raises this question in every country simultaneously. And on the question of sort of formal legal relations, I'm always put in mind of the thoughts of Karl Freund, who was, before he came to Britain, was a great scholar on German law and probably knew more about continental European labour law than anybody else, or mainland labour law.
Mainland.
And he was commenting on the importance, or lack of importance really, of formal rights to strike and to join unions written into countries' constitutions. It's obviously was something which wasn't stressed anywhere in Britain at the time he was writing. But what he argued was that the most important thing wasn't whether or not you had a formal right embedded in a constitution, but how far the legal system allowed you to make your practical rights effective, and for example whether you could picket, picketing obviously has been eroded, but at the time he was writing, whether you could picket effectively was much more important than whether you had a formal legalistic right. So I think one shouldn't underestimate the importance of sort of customary rights. Just a comment on the philosophy of partnership. Of course, partnership can be also a very conservative philosophy, and it's no accident in a way that the idea of the social market economy was first formulated, I guess, by Ludwig Erhard, who was a Christian Democrat, rather than by anyone on the left. And there was a very famous German legal school that stressed that the enterprise was a community, and this is, again, used in a very conservative way. But I think there, two things can change. In a way, the point I quoted from Kotov's study of German co-determination and works councils shows how these things do evolve. And in the 60s and 70s, you could still have works councils that functioned rather close to the rather conservative definition of partnership. But these can be changed even without... They can be changed by the practice of the worker representatives and the trade unions themselves, provided they're aware of those possibilities. But John's a real star tonight, so...
Seems to me that what we've been doing is putting a false polarity between regulation and pressure outside. You clearly need both, don't you? You can't just have pressure from collective, from trade unions. You have to have regulation as well. But regulation won't work without things working at the workplace. And surely that's what David was saying about German works councils. And it's also what we can say here about health and safety legislation. That health and safety legislation worked best when trade unions were strong enough to have safety reps on the ground. And it's in trouble now when they aren't there. And that's the reason we should all be hoping that the thriller with Messrs. Mandelson et al. Has a happy ending, because information and consultation councils at the domestic level gives us the chance to put pressure again.
Actually, I know from friends in the CBI that they scarcely believe, actually, the concessions they get from your Labour. They try them on and then can't believe that they've actually... the things they didn't expect to win, they've won, because they're so anxious, New Labour, to be pleasant to business.
Well, from what I know, the GMB is in favour of the euro, but I can't see if they consulted their members at all. And whereas the TGWU have said that they're against the euro, because most of their members are against it. Now, if you're looking for about how to have a modern version, you know, where trade unions aren't particularly and they're actually reflecting this new democratic age. I mean, trade unions could lead on kind of consulting their members, having decent debates on issues of Europe and the euro. I mean, surely that would be giving, you know, the leading trade unions a different democracy there, not just about kind of workers' rights. I mean, is there any role to be played there for the BNC?
John.
Yes, I mean, I'm pretty sure that in due course there will be votes on the euro in unions, but somebody's really got to fire the starting gun, and the only people who can do that are the government. At the moment, it's the debate about the euro is a very one-sided debate, with the opponents lording the stage with a strident trumpet sound and a very uncertain notes coming from the pro-euro camp. I just say, I mean, in Britain, in Europe, we split between the business community who take the Duesenberg view that the euro is the battering ram for liberalisation and deregulation of Europe, and the people on the left who say, no, it's the way of having a system in Western Europe, hopefully spreading out to Central and Eastern Europe, which will give the United States system a run for its money, as far as the, not just as far as the advanced markets are concerned and our own society, but becomes the model of world development as well. The Americans, being number one, have managed to spread their system extremely successfully, and including in Central and Eastern Europe, over recent years. So it's, the Euro campaign will be a very, very important one. No trade union has had a referendum of its members on it yet. There are plenty of debates going on about it in union councils of one form or another, but we will, when the campaign is not being run by Conrad Black, Rupert Murdoch and the Daily Mail, and a rather uncertain Guardian on these things, when there's a strong lead given, then I think will be the time when this debate will really be joined. At the moment, the pro side is running with a lot of handicaps.
Let's take one more, and I think we should wrap. Yep.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about citizenship, access to information, the offer of choice, accountability, responsiveness, and social partnership. And I'm wondering whether the speakers feel that perhaps the problem with these things, these concepts, is a reflection of the problems between the European Parliament European Commission. In this country, I can buy a register of interests of MPs, but I cannot get any register of interests of MEPs. Seems to me the accountability of the MEPs to me as a citizen, if you want that expression, is rather limited. Although the Labour Group has put their interests on the internet, you've only got access to it from Strasbourg, Luxembourg, and Brussels. Maybe that's a limitation. They want to see the others do at least as much as them in terms of openness and transparency.
Are you saying the website, the European Parliamentary website, can only be accessed from Strasbourg?
Yes, I am.
That's the first time the net's managed. I mean, I don't.
Well, that's why I'm saying from the Guardian and your.
I think surely some mistake, actually. If you log on anywhere but Strasbourg, you can't get on the site.
Right.
I mean,
well, the world doesn't exist there, right? As far as the European Commissioners are concerned, the Commissioners answer three general questions with three general answers. But as far as I can see, there's no obligation on the Commissioner to sign, date, update, or worry about publication, or indeed worry about any penalty for inaccuracy. And inaccuracy should be in quotation marks. And I'm wondering if the panelists feel that your problems in talking up the great developments we should expect from Europe, which is calling, are in fact a reflection of the limitations right at the top.
Okay. Matthew wants to say something. Then a word from Deb if you want to say anything. And then John, the last word. Matthew.
I won't respond to the last point. I don't think it was true, really. But I did want to respond to the point about rights and about... it wasn't about rights and responsibilities. That's how I'm going to interpret it, about who the partners are.
Thank you.
I do think that one of, if we would list of things that disappoint one about New Labour, one of them would be that the rights and responsibilities agenda all seems to be directed at the poor, and it's very rarely directed at anybody else. And I think that many of the things that are wrong with British society to do with the way in which the middle classes and others and the very rich behave, but one wouldn't believe it from the rhetoric. So I share with you the fact that the notion of partnership does need to have a slightly more robust notion of what a good partner from the other side would represent. I think that leads to a question for the left, really, which is, I think we've always, in relation to these issues about good employment practice, we're never quite clear about whether we think capitalism is evil or stupid. Evil in the sense that it has to be regulated to stop it destroying the workers, and stupid in the sense that it has to be regulated in order to understand that the best form of capital, the most effective form of capitalism, is one which is inclusive of workers and based on modern employment practice. And I think there is there's an interesting contrast between the continued lack of popularity in Labour discourse about trade unions, but its commitment to sort of Charles Leadbeater type visions of the modern enterprise being one where everyone meets every day and where there's a massive levels of employee participation. But I think that to conclude, I think it has been a theme to a certain extent. I do think that if you believe, as I do, that good employment practice can actually be part of a profitable firm and will increasingly need to be, particularly in the context of full employment, particularly in the context of the expectations of young people in relation to their working lives, then a strategy which is less about central regulation and more about local empowerment is probably the way forward.
Just a quick comment in response to your, well, I guess Neil Kinnock is meant to deal with your question. Okay, but on the question of
email him.
Top executive pay. I guess one of the reasons why there's been this surge of top executive pay in Britain and the US is that within British and American organisations, top managers could get away with it. The question I'd hold over Germany and countries like that is whether there'd come a time when, if they do allow top executive pay to become detached in the same way, whether the partnership ideas within the enterprise would continue to function just as well. In other words, whether there wouldn't be an economic cost, and that itself might affect then the willingness of firms to tolerate that thing. So I'd see the German status as tending to go with the patterns of corporate governance, which includes the partnership within German companies. Of course, there are pressures from Wall Street now as some of the companies try to get capital from there. But I think the big question mark over Germany is if it goes, how far it can go down the American path before it finds it begins to undermine the productivity advantages it gets from its patterns of industrial partnership.
John?
Just a few remarks really on this last point about partners. I mean, I think executive pay is one of the biggest threats to partnership around at the moment. I mean, I've come to see these partnership arrangements as very, very important by having the privilege of visiting lots of places where they exist. And also being very much aware of the atmosphere in areas where there's either an adversarial industrial relations or there's no unions at all. The last one being very authoritarian, however kindly meant or kindly clothed and very conformist. The adversarial ones, something of a excitement for a few people who enjoy that kind of thing, and misery for a lot of the rest, and a partnership atmosphere where there's a genuine sense of people as a team and working together and so on. Now, I've also found that you can overdo it. Where there's genuine stars around, sort of management Roy Keynes, the people don't really mind. I was quite struck by they didn't seem to mind at JCB that the boss was extremely rich and well healed, because there was a tremendous sense of commitment from the family into the business, and some of the money anyway found its way into all sorts of things in and around Uttoxeter. But the others, that there is genuine resentment, and of course the under the comparability principle, which is one of the main origins of any pay system, the managers are paying themselves to keep up with others and so on. So I do view that as a major problem, and a sort of a boon to the Marxist who says, well, that's capitalism for you, and so on, and all the rest of it. And maybe it is a seed of destruction too for those who are looking for more seismic changes in the way our societies operate if it carries on in this way. I just say that, I mean, I noticed Bayer moving its head office to London today. I just wonder how much that is so they can pay their executives Anglo-Saxon salaries without the censure that is likely to be incurred in Germany at the present time. I watch their salary bills at the top with great interest.
Well, we've ended this with more questions, I think, than answers. But very interesting indeed. Thank you to our two discussants, and thank you, and particularly to John Monks. And, you know, Godspeed. So thank you.